I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A well-known leader in Philadelphia academic circles passed away yesterday after a prolonged illness. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports that he searched for his acres of diamonds in North Philadelphia.
The acres of diamonds speech that anyone could get ahead through hard work is familiar to many Temple University graduates from the 80s and beyond. University founder Russell Conwell said he'd given that speech thousands of times, and his successor, Peter Liacouras, took the North Philadelphia acreage of what was then mostly a commuter school and expanded it into a major force in the region's educational system. Liacouras ran Temple from 1982 through 2000, and Chancellor Richard Englert says he was a man who transformed the main campus.
He was a master strategist. What I liked about him and just so admired is he didn't just read the future, he actually shaped the future. An outside-the-box thinker who was enormously, enormously creative, and he understood that if you bring people to campus, Temple University will sell itself.
Liacouras promoted the school through its athletic program, building the arena that would later be renamed in his honor for basketball on the site of a former car dealership. He moved the football program from a small stadium in Cheltenham to Veterans Stadium, giving every student a season ticket through their activity fund in order to boost game attendance. Englert said Liacouras' strategy worked out, and building more dorm space enticed students to stay on campus.
Our main campus enrollments have gone up some 90% simply because of that.
Liacouras wasn't everyone's hero. Neighbors surrounding the campus protested the spread of the university into the north central Philadelphia neighborhoods around it. A memorial service will be held next Friday at Temple's Performing Arts Center. I'm Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
We've all grumbled about the fees tacked onto a hotel bill, but tourism officials and lawmakers in Pennsylvania say raising one of those taxes may actually encourage more visitors to stay and spend. Keystone Crossroads' Eleanor Klibanoff reports on the increased hotel tax some counties are taking advantage of.
A few weekends each year, hotels in Center County are at full capacity. Penn State football games, Arts Fest, move in, and the big move out. Jim Sauter was in town for his son's graduation last weekend, staying at the Nittany Lion Inn.
Oh, it's about $400 a night. It's usually about $159, $179 a night.
After 4 years of tuition bills, the Sauters weren't looking too closely at the hotel bill for this last hurrah. They said they wouldn't notice or care about a small tax increase. But that tax could help turn these big Penn State weekends into tourism initiatives for the entire county. Center County is one of 57 counties in Pennsylvania that can now raise their hotel tax up to 5%, with the extra earnings going to the Tourism Bureau. County Commissioner Michael Pipe says the increase capitalizes on tourism already happening.
So the whole premise behind the original hotel room tax law was so that there's a fee that was generated that then would be used to get more, as they call them, heads on beds.
The legislation just passed at the end of April, so the county hasn't decided to raise the tax yet. But if they do, it could generate as much as $1.5 million a year. Guests would see their hotel rate increase by a few dollars a night. 10 counties already have a higher hotel tax. In Philadelphia, guests pay 8.5% to the county. In Erie, 7%. But the state had 57 counties capped at 3%. Since 2008, Ann Druck, president of the York County Convention and Visitors Bureau, has been campaigning for the ability to raise the hotel tax in the county.
Lancaster had it at the time, and Dauphin County had it at the time. Our neighboring communities actually had the ability to invest more in their industry, so we were at a competitive disadvantage.
The effort struggled to get legislative attention, but then Druck started putting together a coalition of counties that felt similarly disadvantaged.
We may have gotten it through 4 years ago to help York, but having it take this long and having to work that hard on something that in the end benefited 57 counties is huge.
Counties don't have to raise their hotel tax, but now they all can. York County is the first to do so, with the additional funding going towards marketing York as the factory tour capital of the world. Druck hopes others will follow.
When I looked at the state legislation and analysis that was done, it said that if all these counties that now have the ability to raise their tax from 3 to 5%, in fact, did that, it would generate another $28 million
each year. And that's money these counties could really use. The state's own tourism budget has been slashed over the years, from a high of $41 million down to $2 million a year.
You will be seeing ads. I saw one this morning for Ocean City, Maryland. You'll see them for the state of Utah, for the state of California. You will not see any television ads for Pennsylvania, the Keystone State, Pursue Your Happiness.
So counties have to do all they can to promote tourism on their own. The ability to raise the hotel tax is one way of getting the funding to do that. Tourism officials are banking on the fact that most people won't notice that additional 2% charge on their hotel bill. Eleanor Klibanoff, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY leads the project. The battle over Neshaminy High School's mascot has come to a head once again. Since 2013, school administrators and the student newspaper disagreed about whether the paper can refuse to publish the word Redskins. WHYY's Laura Benchoff reports students say school leadership is now violating their constitutional right to free speech by ordering the paper to publish the name.
At issue is a story about a talent competition called the Mr. Redskin Contest. Neshaminy School District spokesman Chris Stanley says the author of the article in the newspaper, called the Playwickian, asked to have the full mascot name kept in the published version. And that's the version the administration approved.
I mean, the principal and the advisor have to approve every article. So again, it's a supervised setting.
Newspaper staff, however, published the story with the mascot's name redacted, as per their policy. School leaders swiftly took down the online post and revoked student privileges to publish online. Adam Goldstein, attorney with the Student Press Law Center, says while administrations have the power to censor a story, under the First Amendment, a policy can't compel students to say something they don't want to.
The school wants to force this word into their student editor's mouth, which is just astonishing and clearly unconstitutional. If you can't force a student to recite the pledge, you can't force them to write a word they believe to be a racial slur.
Playwickian editor-in-chief Tim Cho, who's been on the newspaper staff for 4 years, says he's looking into legal action to defend his freedom of speech.
I've been through this entire controversy from the beginning until this point. And this is not something I'm just going to give up.
School policy forbids punishing students for editorial decisions. And in case you were wondering, the name of the newspaper comes from a settlement of the Lenni Lenape called Playwiki, which translates to lots of turkeys. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Keep Austin Weird is a slogan adopted by Texas's capital city. Now toiling to uphold the spirit of that unofficial motto are pollsters assembled in Austin at this year's conference of the American Association for Public Opinion Research. That's where we find Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Well, we'll get to the weirdness in a bit. What is the theme of this year's gathering?
The official title, Dave, is Reshaping the Research Landscape, Public Opinion and Data Science. This is all about we pollsters and survey researchers dealing with what we call big data, the availability we have now with massive computing power to provide huge amounts of information on what we're all doing and how we would meld this together with our traditional ways of analyzing public opinion to do our jobs better.
In theory, having that avail of big data would likely mean more reliable results, yes?
Well, that's the interesting question. Certainly, we have much, much, much more data than we've ever had before, so that's the good news. But remember, as we've talked about a lot before, one of the major purposes of the type of public opinion research we do is to try to generalize to the American public. In other words, what would all Americans say about Trump or Obama or policies on trade if we were able to interview them all? And that's the problem. Being able to statistically take all this terabytes and terabytes of data and say, out of all of this, can we actually generalize to what the public would be thinking and feeling about an issue? And that's the challenge.
It looks like some of the seminars relate to the challenge of measuring the size, characteristic, and attitudes of the multiracial population and advancements in cross-cultural and multilingual questionnaire design.
That's absolutely right. That one you mentioned about measuring race and ethnicity is very important. The U.S. Census Bureau has certainly pioneered in this area, but it used to be quite simple. You know, what is your race? Are you white, black, or other? But now The census has given up on single categories and allows people to respond that they are a number of different races if they feel that's how they want to identify themselves, and it becomes very complex for a survey researcher.
Let's note that you were a past president, I believe, back in 2010. What are the challenges for the president of this association?
Well, the challenges are many. It is an association where the president, like myself, come and go. You know, we are elected, we serve one term, and then we go. We have a professional staff that runs the association.
I thought it was the culmination of a brutal campaign season.
We all have the best pollsters available to us, I'll say that.
Of course.
So the challenge of the president of the organization is to try to give a direction, to inspire the members, to come up with new ways of approaching what we're doing, come up with new innovations, keep the staff on task, keep the membership high, keep people interested, and so on and so forth. Our current president, who made her presidential address today at APOR, is Dr. Molly Ann Brody, who's head of all research at the Kaiser Family Foundation out in San Francisco, that do a lot of research on health care and the Affordable Care Act.
When you spoke about attendees and growing that cohort, how many pollsters are in Austin right now?
I think it's well over 1,000. That's the good news. Attendance at these associations have actually been growing. It's a combination of people from three major areas of life. We do have academics, professors, and others who teach statistics, methods, political science, sociology, economics. We have people such as myself who are in what we might call the private sector, polling firms and other organizations that do this type of work. And we have a large contingent of pollsters and professionals who come here from the U.S. government and from state governments, because a lot of our fundamental foundational polling work is actually conducted by the government.
Now let's get to the good part. What do these academics, pollsters, and government workers do when the conference closes down for the day?
Well, quite interesting. We've been getting emails from some of our local people here about all of the fantastic music that's available on 6th Street. You know, there's an Austin scene now, kind of like Nashville has been. And you can, kind of like Bourbon Street in New Orleans, go up and down these streets and the open-air cafes and you hear music coming, so it's really fascinating. Of course, I myself will be working all this time and won't have time to take advantage of it.
That goes without saying. Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Still ahead, a new exhibition focuses on ancient African artifacts as art rather than pieces of history.
Before we frame them with a lot of didactic material, maps, and tell you which, you know, societies are matriarchal and which are patriarchal, and we're asking you to just use your eyes and see what the objects can tell you in their own right.
NewsWorks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to NewsWorks Tonight. I'm Dave Heller. The acquittal of George Zimmerman in the 2012 shooting of unarmed black teenager Trayvon Martin sparked controversy on race relations. This week, the gun used in the altercation made its way onto an online auction site. The controversial auction reminds NewsWorks blogger Solomon Jones of his time with Trayvon's father.
When I learned that George Zimmerman was attempting to auction off the gun he used to kill unarmed black teen Trayvon Martin, I was angry. The thought of him profiting from shooting a 17-year-old boy was sickening to me, because Zimmerman not only killed Martin, he victimized Martin's parents as well. Even after Zimmerman was acquitted after claiming self-defense, he twisted the knife by trying to auction what he called the firearm that was used to defend my life and end the brutal attack from Trayvon Martin. Zimmerman planned to start the bidding for the 9mm pistol at $5,000. Thankfully, GunBroker.com, the first website Zimmerman tried to use to sell the gun, refused to participate. A second website was apparently infiltrated by hackers who purportedly submitted fake bids. Meanwhile, Trayvon's parents, Sabrina Fulton and Tracy Martin, declined to comment, choosing instead to focus on the Anti-Gun Violence Foundation they named for their son. But even in their silence, I know the family is hurting, because I spoke with Trayvon's father last year, and I came away knowing how much Tracy Martin loved his son. When Trayvon was born, Tracy Martin cut the umbilical cord and held his baby boy close. Their relationship tightened over the years, even as Tracy Martin's marriage to Sabrina Fulton ended in divorce. When he was 9 years old, Trayvon Martin dragged his father to safety after the elder Martin burned his legs in a grease fire. As he grew older, he and his father bonded over sports, and Trayvon played in parks with children of all stripes. When he was 17, Trayvon was visiting his father when he left to go to a local convenience store to buy snacks. On his way back, he was confronted by Zimmerman. Trayvon never made it home. Tracy Martin reported his son missing at 4:30 a.m. 2 hours later, the police came to see him. It didn't dawn on me that the first person to introduce himself to me was the chaplain for the police department, Martin told me when I spoke with him last year. And then the detective came up. He introduced himself. He said he was with the Major Crimes Unit. The detectives talked with Tracy Martin for a few minutes more, and the father showed them a recent picture of his son. The detectives asked what Trayvon was wearing when he last saw him, and then they showed the father a picture. "You tell me if this is your son," the detective said. And he pulled out a picture, and it was him on the ground dead. When I spoke with Tracy Martin, he was still struggling with trying to forgive the man who killed his son. "Will I ever forgive?" he asked. "I don't know. Will I ever forget? I know I definitely won't ever forget." Thanks to George Zimmerman's cold-blooded attempt to cash in on killing a boy, Tracy Martin couldn't forget if he wanted to. And with the pain Zimmerman has already caused to Trayvon Martin's family, that sad fact angers me most of all. I'm Solomon Jones.
Solomon Jones writes the Philadelphia Experiment blog at newsworks.org. Young men of color are disproportionately affected by violence and trauma, but it can be difficult to find social services that take these circumstances into account. A new online hub and collaborative called Healing Works wants to change that. From WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Anne Hoffman reports.
Violence, poverty, abuse, neglect. A lot of young men of color have experienced these painful traumas. While services for these men are out there, the providers haven't been connected under a common banner.
Churches, religious organizations do this work because it's so necessary, but we aren't naming it for what it is, and we're not elevating it for what it is, and we're not resourcing it for what it is, which is necessary healing work for this population of people who are so disproportionately victimized.
That's Charlene Allen, the director of partnerships at Common Justice, the organization that created the Healing Works Hub. Allen believes that this specific brand of culturally aware healing is a new and evolving field that needed a digital space to grow. So on Healing Works, different service providers can come together and share strategies to deal with their clients' challenges. The hope is that one day, the public will be as informed about young men of color and trauma as they are about domestic violence. Dorothy Johnson Spate from the Philadelphia group Mothers in Charge is happy to be joining the hub. She says unhealed trauma can create problems for communities down the line.
A lot of the offenders or perpetrators or whatever you want to call them are victims themselves, so we know that hurt people will hurt other people.
Healing Works has also put together a framework for culturally relevant services. Key components include using spiritual traditions to promote healing and encouraging male victims to counsel their peers. Anne Hoffman, WHYY News.
Through the summer, the Philadelphia Museum of Art is showing five different exhibitions related to Africa. From WHYY's Arts and Culture Desk, Peter Crimmins reports the group of shows called Creative Africa ranges from ancient tribal art to the freshest contemporary design.
The Philadelphia Museum of Art asked the University of Pennsylvania's Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, which has a massive collection of African artifacts, to collaborate on an exhibition called Look Again. It's the centerpiece of a five-part show called Creative Africa. Because it's an art museum and not a history museum, curator Christina Van Dyke could emphasize the physical artifacts on their own more so than the history and culture they came out of.
Before we frame them with a lot of didactic material, maps, and tell you which, you know, societies are matriarchal and which are patriarchal, and the kind of information that usually comes with an African show, we're asking you to just use your eyes and see what the objects can tell you in their own right.
The four other exhibitions in the museum's annex building, the Perlman Building, take a more contemporary look at Africa. There's an exhibition of clothing made from the bright, boldly patterned textiles often associated with West and Central Africa. But they're actually manufactured by a company in the Netherlands and exported to Africa. The complications of trying to identify a purely African art in a globalized world is embodied in the young architect Francis Carey, who grew up in a small village in the West African nation of Burkina Faso, but he left there to study architecture in Germany. There, he designed a school for his old village using native materials, passive cooling, and innovative building techniques that could be adopted by the villagers.
I was coming from a very poor region, a very poor village where there was no school. But there, it is hot. It could be over 100 Fahrenheit, so it's very hot. What I did is just to use my skills and adapt it to the climate condition and even to the social condition of the people.
The exhibition of Carré's work will be up until the end of September. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yakov and Kimberly Haas, with additional production from Brett Rader. Our news director is Eugene Son. At the controls this week, Bob Alls, Charlie Kyer, and Adam Staniszewski. John Mussoni is acting vice president of news and civic dialogue. Listen again to a story or catch up on a missed show via podcast or online at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.